Hello, and welcome back to Bench to Bedside. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Firth, Executive Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer of the Research Institute. In this four-part series of our podcast, we're meeting the leaders of our Frontier programs, which are launching in 2023. Frontier programs are selected because they include visionary research that translates to cutting-edge clinical care. They offer answers which are often not available anywhere else in the world. My guest today is physician scientist Elizabeth Foglia, who is co-leading the Delivery Room of the Future Frontier Program. Welcome, Dr. Foglia. We're really excited about the Frontier Program, the Delivery Room of the Future. CHOP has a long history of innovation when it comes to neonatal care and taking care of the tiniest babies. I think one of the first incubators was developed here. We founded the nation's first surgical ICU for newborns and infants in 1962. And today, the hospital's home to one of the most preeminent neonatal surgical teams in the nation. Can you tell us what the future delivery room will look like?
Absolutely. So our vision for the future is that every baby born will have a team that's prepared to know exactly what to do for the baby on the basis of who that baby is. So individualized approach to resuscitation on the basis of the baby's inherent anatomy and physiology, that will understand how to support our team to operationalize that with regards to team performance and interacting in the space, and will be able to deliver clinical decision support to our team in real time using a state-of-the-art clinical decision tool that we're calling a digital coach.
And is the vision that that digital coach could be developed here at CHOP but then used elsewhere?
Absolutely. We see this as a prototype that could be used and scaled to other acute care settings, whether that's within the hospital or beyond CHOP.
And how will research provide the evidence to create the delivery room of the future?
This is near and dear to my heart because I'm a clinical investigator. So one of the big gaps that we have when we think about resuscitation for babies with anomalies is we really don't understand what that physiology looks like after birth for babies with major anatomical differences or defects. So one of the big aims of our program is to start to characterize what we call transitional physiology, what happens in terms of the heart, the lungs, the rest of the body system as the baby moves from being inside the womb to outside the womb. And we know what that looks like in babies without anomalies, but no one's defined what that looks like for babies with anomalies. And so without understanding what that transitional physiology looks like, it's very hard to generate evidence-based guidelines for how you should resuscitate babies to support that transition.
And so who will the target population be?
The target population reflects the type of babies who are born in the special delivery unit at CHOP. So these are babies with major congenital anomalies, congenital diaphragmatic hernia, critical heart disease, whose differences and their anatomic anomalies are diagnosed in utero, and they're born to healthy moms who deliver their babies within the walls of CHOP.
Can you tell us a little bit about what we've learned over the course of, say, your career that informs what you're planning to do in the delivery room of the future?
Absolutely. When we think on a global scale in terms of neonatal outcomes, birth asphyxia remains one of the biggest causes of neonatal morbidity and mortality. So efforts to improve child health really should focus on efforts to improve the care that we deliver right after birth. And we call that period of time right after birth the golden hour. So we know from full-term babies without anomalies and preterm babies that the care we deliver in that golden hour is really important to prevent morbidity and mortality. That was known before I started my career. I think the biggest shift that's happened throughout my career is an increased focus on objective physiologic monitoring during resuscitation. It's a really nice arc. You know, folks who came before me started by defining, what does your heart rate trajectory look like after birth? What do oxygen saturation trajectories look like after birth? And first, just defining what that looks like in a normal baby who is able to successfully transition without any intervention. And then we've focused the lens on preterm infants and started to say, well, what are those trajectories for preterm infants? And what are some of the time-critical targets for preterm infants after birth that, if we can meet those targets, are associated with decreases in morbidity and mortality? And that's the blueprint that we're now going to apply to babies with anomalies at CHOP.
What's an example of a time-critical target?
Sure. Every fetus has low oxygen saturation levels. That's normal. So a fetus will emerge from the womb with an oxygen saturation level of about 60%. And it takes 10 to 15 minutes for their oxygen saturation levels to reach normal, like you or I, 100%. We've seen from large observational studies of preterm infants that if preterm infants fail to meet the time-critical target of 80% saturation by 5 minutes, they have a higher risk of death and they have a higher risk of major brain bleeds. So that becomes one of these time-critical targets that when we're focused on resuscitation of a preterm infant, we know that we need to focus on getting enough oxygen to that baby to meet that target.
We talked a little bit about how things have changed over time. Can you speak to even the approach or understanding of how to take care of infants who are born with anomalies?
The Delivery Room of the Future project wouldn't exist without the special delivery unit. This project really came from our experience as clinicians that evolved from the fact that we had this very innovative approach at CHOP to delivering healthy mothers with these infants in a children's hospital. This was a major paradigm shift for perinatal care.
So you work both in the clinical setting and do research that then translates back to the bedside. Are there anecdotes of your work as a clinician that have inspired you to do this work?
I feel really fortunate that I get to wear both hats, and I think my work as a clinical neonatologist very much informs my work as a clinical investigator. If we take that oxygen saturation example, we know, like I said, for the preterm infants, we've defined what the time-critical targets are. One of the first questions that prompted this line of work for me was caring for a baby with critical heart disease. It's a baby with transposition of the great arteries. That baby's never going to have normal oxygen saturations just on the basis of their anatomy. And so that, to me, is a very tangible example of what we're trying to solve here.
And to build that evidence base, will that be based on patients only here at CHOP?
We're starting here at CHOP. We're obviously very open to collaboration with other centers, but I think first we're really looking to define the blueprint of what type of data are we collecting, and to make sure that we can harmonize any data that we are collecting, both with regards to physiologic data and outcome data. It would need to be carefully harmonized to make sure that that's a rigorous approach.
And tell me, you mentioned about eventually there would be a coach. Fast forward 5 or 10 years, what would that be like?
So the vision, 5 years from now, if I get called to a delivery in the special delivery unit, there's a screen on the wall. It already has all of the information I need to know about that patient. I'm not hunting through Epic. It's telling me, here's the diagnosis, here's the estimated patient weight, here's a picture of the patient's anatomy, and it's pulling up a diagnosis-specific resuscitation algorithm. It's giving that to the entire team, and then it's linked to the monitors that we're using in real time. So I'm not looking at a monitor and then looking at a clock and then looking at my algorithm and thinking, okay, am I on target? What should I be doing next? It's prompting me in real time. You're not meeting the target. Do you want to go up on oxygen? Should you think about starting respiratory support? That's what the future looks like in our eyes.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I think it will have huge impact. And if you're successful, how would you see this potentially changing the lives of children and changing the way clinicians practice?
I think first and foremost, we would love to get to a point that what we learn here at CHOP is integrated into the resuscitation algorithm and guidelines that are disseminated nationally and internationally. That would be the first step in terms of the path from discovery to implementation.
Can you tell us the story of how you took up this area as your area of interest in neonatal resuscitation?
Yeah, I got really lucky, is the honest answer. I started my neonatal training at a time that two very prominent neonatal trialists were here at CHOP, and they became my mentors. So that was Barbara Schmidt and Harish Kirplani. And they trained me and taught me very well about clinical trials and clinical epidemiology. And simultaneous to that, I started to develop an affinity for resuscitation clinically. And I noticed that our PICU colleagues had established a really well-grounded resuscitation science program for pediatric patients. And so really, it was, again, a very fortunate timing for me that I had mentorship from neonatal clinicians and experts who could teach me how to approach neonatal science, but also with content expertise from pediatric resuscitation.
So it sounds like you trained at CHOP and stayed at CHOP. Can you tell us what about CHOP and about the research institute that's inspired you to stay and build your research career here?
Yeah, again, I feel incredibly fortunate to be here. I think when I came as a trainee, I was looking for a place where I would receive excellent clinical training, which I did. And the longer I stayed, the more I came to appreciate just the excellence in terms of the research environment. So to me, probably the single biggest attribute of the research institute is just the longitudinal legacy, the fact that I was trained by people who were at the top of their field, who absolutely supported me to pursue my own research agenda. And now that I'm at mid-level, I have an opportunity to train the next generation. And that's actually one of my favorite parts of my job.
That's a big part of who we are here at CHOP and what makes it new and inspiring every day. So what continues to inspire you?
The other thing I really like about CHOP and Penn is the ability to collaborate with people with different areas of expertise. So right now I'm working with Chris Bonafide, who's an implementation scientist, and we're putting together a trial that's a hybrid implementation effectiveness trial. And I can bring the neonatal expertise and the effectiveness piece, and he's bringing the implementation piece. And it's a really neat opportunity to work with someone with a different skill set, different area of expertise, and hopefully innovate in the field.
So tell us a little bit what an implementation and effectiveness trial looks like.
I've been learning a lot over the last few months. This is called a hybrid implementation effectiveness trial. And the idea is if you have an evidence-based intervention that's not very well used or hasn't penetrated the clinical practice to where you think it should be, the aims of the trial are really twofold. The first is to define and test different approaches to implementation. How do I get clinicians to do what the guidelines are already telling them to do? And so the outcome of that aim of the trial really is just uptake of the evidence-based practice. And the second half of the equation is, what is the impact of having the clinicians uptake your practice on clinical outcomes? And so when you design these trials, you're really, it's two distinct aims, one on the implementation front, one on the effectiveness front.
And what's your measure of effectiveness?
This is a different trial that we're actually designing to conduct across 24 delivery room hospitals in the U.S., and we're looking at use of a supraglottic airway or a laryngeal mask for full-term babies who don't respond to face mask positive pressure ventilation. So the implementation aim is, can we define approaches to increase providers' use of the laryngeal mask? And that outcome, the effectiveness outcome is, by doing so, will we reduce how many babies have breathing tubes placed or how many are intubated during resuscitation.
I look forward to hearing the results of the trial. It sounds great. Well, thank you so much for your work. It's so important. Really excited to hear more about the delivery room of the future.
Thanks for having me.
For more stories about the people of the Research Institute and the incredible work that they're doing, visit our blog, Cornerstone, at research.chop.edu/cornerstone-blog. Thanks very much.